Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like mugs at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
Hello everyone.
It is the 20th of July and this is episode 69. We've got a really nice show for you guys coming up. We are going to be talking to, well not us, but Gideon Rosner, one of the great friends of the podcast here, an occasional fill-in. He's going to be talking to former New Zealand Prime Minister Bill English, and they're going to be talking about welfare reform and a whole bunch of cool things. So we've got that that audio coming up for you later in the show. We're also going to be talking to one of our best friends here at the podcast, Daniel Wild. We haven't had him on for a while, but he's just come out today with a new parliamentary research brief on the five reasons to... Oh, I've absolutely completely forgotten. The five reasons that we should abandon the National Energy Guarantee.
Good save.
Thank you. Seamless, I would say.
Oh, no.
Did anyone notice that?
I didn't.
I certainly didn't.
No,
and we're also going to be talking to him about some of the stuff about Trump in Helsinki, which I think we might start with, Pete. So
okay.
You've been following this closely.
I have been following this
the
closely.
The professional commentator, Peter Gregory.
Because it is my job, James, to be abreast of such developments like this. G'day, Nana. Nothing, how are you going? Nana Lohanatha pushing the buttons for us.
Nothing gets past the ever-watchful gaze of Peter Gregory.
Yeah. Okay, so Trump. Trump, as we know, met Vladimir Putin during the week in Helsinki. It was a very controversial meeting. You would know if you hadn't noticed by now. The main thing was in the press conference afterwards, he was very lavish in his praise of Putin, which drew a lot of ire at home amongst the commentators. And he was also said that he believed that there was no reason to believe that Russia would be responsible for meddling in the elections in 2016. Then when he returned to the USA 24 hours later, amid a huge backlash, he actually said, well, you know, I misspoke.
Yeah.
I meant to say they wouldn't be responsible.
Yeah. So good save.
Yeah. Well, I don't
as seamless a transition as the one I just had before.
Yeah, no one noticed. Anyway.
Yeah, so it's interesting because it's like usually it's not in Trump's game plan to backtrack on previous comments. Usually just is like going on to the next one. So this one seriously, like there's been, we'll talk about this with Daniel.
He's had backflips before.
He's had backflips, but it's like, we'll talk about this with Daniel, but like in a whole range of like, you know, oh, this is the smoking gun that proves Russian collusion. This one seems to have rattled Trump a bit more than the others to the point of like on the flight home going, okay, we need to... Well, like, you know, that's pretty embarrassing to say, oh, I misspoke. I meant to say wouldn't when I said would.
Yeah.
Like, that's embarrassing. And for Trump to do that, it means, like, that was really bad.
Well, the reason for that was because he got a lot of criticism from people who normally support him.
Yes.
So both Republicans who normally support him bagged him about this.
Yeah.
People like Newt Gingrich. And also lots of people on Fox News who normally, so commentators who normally support him on everything, had a crack at him about this. There's kind of, the criticism is like, oh, you know, the international norms say that you've given this guy a huge propaganda free kick, basically. You know, you've lavished praise on him. He's a bad guy. You know, he invaded Ukraine, meddled in the elections in 2016, but there's no doubt about that. And he, you know, has designs on all these Baltic states with Russian-speaking communities. He repressed his own population. Anyway, we all know why Putin's a bad guy.
Yeah, that could be the whole podcast. Like, we do have other... We've got to get to these interviews, Pete.
Yeah, exactly right. So, but there's another view, which is a much smaller view, is that actually, you know, Trump is a really good negotiator. He knows what he's doing behind closed doors. He was probably a lot more tough with Putin than he was in public, and that's part of the whatever it is he's trying to achieve. I don't know. I mean, who knows what the actual...
Well, that seems to be the one that he's rolling with. I don't know if you saw Trump's follow-up tweet saying people with very high IQs have loved the press conference.
Yeah.
I worry for the people that didn't love the press conference.
Studies
on that.
Show that people with IQs like the... But I mean, look, if he was so sure of what he was doing, then why would he backflip 24 hours later?
Yeah, exactly. So I want to share something which I thought was really cool commentary on. This came from Ben Shapiro. So this was tweeted out yesterday. Two things can be true at once. Says Ben Shapiro. There's no solid evidence Trump colluded with Russia. That's one. And second, Russia certainly hacked the DCCC, DNC, and the Hillary campaign. So Trump only believes, number one, that there's no solid evidence. And thus, he's so committed to that I didn't collude with Russia, that he refuses to believe that the Russians hacked the DNC, which explains that I don't see why Russia would have done this. Democrats believe, too, that they were hacked by Russia, and therefore... and thus don't believe one, which is like Democrats are fully like Trump did it. He colluded. And Benji Berry says, both are wrong, which I thought was really good because it sort of shows what we're talking about here.
Trump must surely know they collude. They interfered with the...
Well, I wonder if it's like if he admits that the Democrats were hacked, therefore like he has to admit the Russians had involvement and he's just so strong. There's like an almost concession there. For him, if he says like, okay, there was involvement, then that sort of emboldens people to say, well, then therefore Republicans colluded, which he's so saying never happened.
Yeah, and he doesn't want his election victory to be discredited as
exactly,
well.
Exactly, yeah. So anyway, we'll be talking to that with Daniel Wilde, who is a very big Trump fan, so it'd be interesting to hear what he takes out of that.
Look, if at the end of the day, in a couple of years' time, we say, gee, Trump's done a really good job with Putin in reigning in Russia, then, you know, good luck to him. But at this...
And we just go back and delete this podcast?
Yeah.
And no one will ever know. But seamless.
It just looks like... At this, like, I mean, you know. Anyway, the proof will be the pudding.
It will be. Cool. That's so right. We'll move on to a new story. So this one, a bit closer to home. In fact, it happened like probably a few streets away from us. So Lauren Southern, we covered this on the podcast last week. She's a Canadian political commentator, activist, professional provocateur, says this article I read.
that is the worst description.
That's terrible.
If you describe yourself as a professional provocateur, you're not.
You're not. Also, you're annoying. Yeah. But anyway, she doesn't describe herself as that, as far as I know. That's just the article. But anyway, she's in Australia. She's giving a speaking tour. And with a controversial speaker such as Lawrence Southern, along come people protesting. Mm. Victoria Police have now spent a lot of money on extra security for this event, and they've decided to fit Lauren Southern with some of the bill to the tune of $68,000,
yes,
which is really bad.
Which is massive victim shaming.
Yes, James. It's your fault that we need these police, and therefore you shall pay for it.
Yeah, well, I mean, this happened with Milo as well. Apparently he hasn't paid, or the organisers haven't paid the $50,000 that they were billed by Vic Poles.
Yep, so that's nor should they.
Emerging story. I mean, it's crazy that people are going to come and cause violence at your event that you have to pay for the police.
Yeah, that's your fault.
That's taking user pays to the next level.
Yeah.
I don't know what they do with stuff like the footy, though. Like, to the AFL, I think, gives cash to the police.
Well, no one's finding the AFL's political views controversial.
Well, I mean, so, I do.
but
I'll still go.
You and I aren't going to go march in the streets.
Nah,
well, we march in the streets, but we'll end up at the G watching the footy. But anyway.
Putting my hard earned through the bar.
So, just don't have controversial views, I think, would be Victoria Police's policy stance on these things.
Save us the trouble. Don't express your views.
Please don't report things.
I did notice there was a video that Lauren Southern filmed on the streets of Melbourne near my university.
Mm-hmm.
I almost said alma mater, but not quite. University.
One day. One glorious day.
I'm getting close. I'm getting so close. RMIT University, and it was interviewing people, and it was saying, should we kill Lauren Southern, right? So she was pretending to not be Lauren Southern.
Because, like, no one would know who Lauren Southern is on site.
Like, a few people...
Unless you watched their videos, but like...
Yeah, well, she's pretty... I mean, a few people were like, but you're Lauren Southern. She would be like, no. But anyway, she was asking, should we kill Lauren Southern? And a few of them, I mean, like the vast majority of people were like, yes, we should. You know, and like often they'd be like, who is she? And she'd be like,
she wouldn't say I'm. That would give the game away completely.
She was like, oh, she's a fascist. She's a racist, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, yeah, we should kill her. And it's like, you can make jokes about violence against women if... The woman's right wing, I guess, is the lesson out of that.
That's what I'm taking out of it.
Okay, fair enough.
All right, cool. Move on to another one. So we've got IMF corporate tax.
Let's do it. Oh, this is me. Yeah, okay.
it's called a volleyball spike. sending it up for you, mate.
Yeah, no, very good. Very good, James. I'll be quicker on that next time. So during the week, there was a report from the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, about the impact of corporate tax cuts in America and what that would mean for other countries in terms of multinational entities. And Australia was the second worst hit in the world in lost revenue as a result of multinational entities moving their operations profit shifting to the United States, with the second hardest hit in the world behind Mexico, actually. Mexico is like double us, so, I mean, you know, Mexico's in trouble,
yeah.
But we're also in trouble, and unless we make a huge tax cut as well, then that's another way that, you know, Australia's going to be worse off.
All right, good. Well, it's a good thing that giant corporate tax cut is just right around the corner, so...
By 2023...
That could have been close.
By 2100...
Yeah.
We'll be...
Almost competitive. Would be almost competitive with the US. Cool. So if you want to read that report, we linked to that in Hey, What Did I Miss Yesterday? Right at the top of the email. And if you do want to hear more about corporate tax, you can just go back through the archives. Anytime we've had Daniel Wilde on, we probably have brought it up at least once. So you can go back and listen to that. Cool. So last one I want to talk about here. So Mark Duplass, he's a director. I might be pronouncing his surname wrong, but I don't think I am. But anyway, he's a director. You might know him from the new Netflix documentaries Wild Wild Country and Evil Genius, which were both awesome. And he's also directed the criminally underrated Skeleton Twins. So go out and watch that one. I'm just saying, it's a good movie.
James Bolt. Talking up a piece of popular culture that he thinks is not highly rated. is one of the great sort of
annoyances in life.
Not well. I was going to give you. I'm self-aware. Yeah, it's pretty annoying.
Yeah, I'm self-aware.
I was going to say anyway. Go on.
Anyway, so he tweeted out yesterday, fellow liberals, if you're interested at all in like crossing the aisle in inverted commas, you should consider following Ben Shapiro. I don't agree with him on much, but he's a genuine person who once helped me out for no other reason than to be nice. He doesn't bend the truth. His intentions are good.
Here's this guy. I agree with him sometimes. Not all the time.
He's a nice enough guy. Definitely worth hearing out.
Yep.
Give him a follow.
Okay.
Can't be doing that though.
No.
This guy got dragged on Twitter in ways that you just cannot precedent. Well, you can precedent. It happens all the time. But this one, particularly vicious. A lot of people coming out of the woodwork. So I saw one. So like, you know, and then Ben Shapiro gets involved and Dave Rubin gets involved. And so Dave Rubin sort of was like commenting on it as, oh, look what happens when the quote unquote tolerant left gets involved on something like this. To which Tom Arnold, people might remember him as Roseanne Barr's ex-husband and, you know, just weird dude in general. I think he was on like Celebrity, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here recently.
Not familiar with Tom's work, but I'll take
anyway, reference. Sorry. He's become one of the more unhinged Trump voters who threatened to, like, if you want to talk about this Mark Duplass thing, since tweeting at Dave Rubin, if you want to talk about this Mark Duplass thing, you're going to have to deal with me. Not just like, Pete doesn't really know who Tom Arnold is, but anyone out there, I can't imagine something less intimidating than Tom Arnold threatening to deal with you.
Yep, right. Fair enough.
That's my thing. But anyway, sorry. Dragging happened on and on and on. Mark Duplass has now apologized for merely suggesting that someone is
You're
worth hearing.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, I almost want to read this out in full because it's just so bad. So that tweet was a disaster on many levels. I want to be clear that in no way I endorse hatred, racism, homophobia, xenophobia, or any such form of intolerance.
You coward.
My goal has always been to spread unity, understanding, and kindness, but I am going to make mistakes along the way, and it just goes on and on and on.
He's a candidate for, what's it called? Walk away.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like, this is crazy. Why am
I don't think like that seems like kowtowing. But like, I like how when Ben Shapiro goes from a day from being like, hey, someone like in Mark Duplass's mind, it's like, hey, someone worth hearing to. No, he's actually a hater, racist, homophobic, and xenophobic.
And this is a guy who's got a like, he's a famous guy.
He's a pretty big privilege. Like, yeah, Wild Country and Evil Genius were huge.
And he doesn't stick by his pretty reasonable statement.
Yep. Fair enough.
And these are the people who are like, oh, you know, the state of political discourse is so abrasive these days.
I can't believe what Trump voters are doing to the state of debate. Yeah, exactly. Cool. So those are the stories. So IPA had a busy week this week with two op-eds on the website you guys can read about. So this morning, Daniel Wilde was talking about the National Energy Guarantee. So you can read that on our website. We'll also be talking to him in about 15 minutes on this show. So you can stick around for that.
He's on Sky as we speak.
Well, probably wrapping up. And we've also got Morgan Begg, great friend of the podcast. He was in The Spectator Australia yesterday talking about GST redistribution and why the fight is still not over. So if you do care about those issues, go to our website, ipa.org.au. And
did you do John's article?
Sorry?
Did you do John's article?
That was last week. We talked about it last
week. Oh, did we?
Yeah.
Oh, because it's Friday. So I got the Thursday and the Friday. Yep, sorry.
It's okay, babe. So time is like a
forward construct. I just didn't want you to forget the boss.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's good looking,
I was looking
after
you. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. But the physical realities of time do exist in this podcast.
Well, that's confusing.
We'll get there one day. Cool. So on our Facebook page, we've got a few videos. So Gideon Rosner was on Sky this week and he gave Elon Musk the serve that he deserves.
Oh.
And we'll be talking about Elon Musk later in the show. So you can go watch that. He's also talking about what education policy the government should be looking for, a bit less political activism, a bit more focus on skills. And Simon Breeny discussed energy policy and affordability on Sky News as well. So that's all on our Facebook website, Facebook page. I don't know what I'm doing. Cool. So we'll go to those interviews now. But thank you guys so much for listening and subscribing. We are available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify. I think we're going to launch YouTube very soon.
Could I say a special g'day to our 15 Swedish listeners on Spotify?
Yeah, so we looked up on Spotify. We've got 15 listeners in Sweden, so I probably should have said thank you in Sweden or bother to look that up maybe later in the show. Yeah. But yeah, so if... Yeah, you can subscribe on any of those platforms. If you do have someone that you've been trying to get listen to the podcast, they don't have iTunes, just tell them we're on Spotify now and they can download and listen through there. Nino, if people want to make even more of a financial commitment to the IPA, where can they go to become a member? Where can they go to donate?
Well, just visit our website, ipa.org.au, and click on the join button or the donation button. And by becoming a member, you can become one of the voice of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
Cool, let's go.
I was just going to say on you, Nino.
Good work. Yep.
Thank you.
Let's go to those interviews now.
So So Bill English, thank you so much for sitting down with the IPA and giving us some of your time today. The first thing I want to ask is, you were the finance minister in and then the prime minister of probably the most successful centre-right government in living memory. And I think that part of that success is the fact that the Key and English governments demonstrated that good economic policy does not come at the expense of good social policy and good social outcomes, that the two are actually complementary. What do you put that down to?
Well, you're quite right. The two do go together. And I think in the government of which I was a part, we had quite a strong focus on how they were connected and on maintaining a broad range of support. You know, often centre-right governments assume that their voters and other voters aren't that interested in what happens with social policy, but we found that almost everyone's concerned about how a government deals with its toughest issues and the most challenging individuals and families in their community.
Mm-hmm. And in 2015, you made a speech here in Melbourne, and one line that caught my attention was that when you said, "Sometimes I wonder if the post-war welfare state was set up to service misery rather than reduce it." What do you mean by that?
Well, if you look at how the incentives on the people who actually operate the machine, they are very, very often quite well-intentioned people. But it's not a machine that that benefits from there being less to do. So the traditional cycle in social policy is that there's a problem, programs are announced, more money gets spent, doesn't solve the problem, so you go through the cycle again. Problem's even bigger or at least persistent, so more resource is applied. And it's a bit of a backwards way of thinking about it, isn't it? So if you've got all misery in your community, people want that fixed, if at all possible. We want the best for our fellow citizens. Then we tend to reward the organisations where the problems don't get resolved, because not fixing it gets more resource, more growth, more jobs, more spending. So we spend a bit of time trying to rethink what the welfare state focuses on. And actually it should be focusing on reducing the misery, particularly for those people who are most disadvantaged.
We talk a lot here at the IPA about the dignity of work and the importance of work, not just for its economic benefits and its benefits to the economy as a whole, but the importance of work in itself for individual people and the importance of getting people into work on a social and a moral level. What does that mean to you as somebody who, I suppose, got a record number of New Zealanders off welfare? I think you cut welfare numbers there by about a third over the lifetime of the Key and English governments.
Well, it was significant. Bear in mind, it was in the context of a significant recession in 2019 and then an economy that grew pretty steadily and at times pretty strongly through a period of 7 or 8, 9 years. So, you know, the economic environment was good for getting people off welfare. But I think the real challenge is with those groups who have still no connection with work whatsoever, even in strong economies such as Australia's had now for 25 years. You'd think that everyone would have had a crack at a job by now in Australia, but it hasn't actually happened. And I think I've come to the conclusion that a lot of the way government interacts with people with no or very loose connection to work makes it harder for them. So, for instance, we put people on disability pensions and then pay no attention to them. Well, as the months go by, set and forget, as the months go by, they lose their social capacities, their connections, their motivation. That's all utterly predictable, but the welfare states let that happen for 30 years. Or other groups who are right out on the edge of the system, they avoid all government services, are deeply mistrustful of them for good reason. They're angry and dissociated. And that's because they get, one of the reasons at least, is because when government interacts with them, it does it in a way that undermines what small social capital or personal resilience they might have. And so I think there's ways that government can get a much better understanding of those groups of people that it's traditionally left on the sideline and can get much more active about what it does with them.
So one ethic that the Key and English governments brought to being in government was the idea of social investment as a mechanism for social policy. Can you talk me through about what that involves and how that differs from welfare policy as we know it currently?
Well, it's a toolkit for government just making much better decisions that are relevant to the people it pretends to support. And that means using toolkit that's much more readily available now. So data and data analytics can give you fantastic insights now using longitudinal models like actuaries use for insurance. Enables you to see what happens to people over a lifetime. So someone can look like they're pretty low cost, you know, a young person on an unemployment benefit or on a disability benefit at the age of 21. They don't look, this year you just pay them that benefit and not much else happens. But actually they could be there for 40 years. And you can get a pretty clear picture of what makes it more likely that they'll stay for 40 years. And the principle of social investment says, well, let's do something about it now. And let's do more about it now. Or with our highest risk children, who in our world cost $1 million before they're age 35.
Million dollar kids.
Yeah. And it's not the $1 million is it, that's the problem. It's the misery that represents. The waste of potential.
Yeah.
When you know that, it creates a lot more motivation to deal with what's actually quite a small number of children in our community and do it properly, you know, deal with their real health problems, put quite a bit more resource into getting them permanent homes where they're going to be loved and cared for. These are all things people want, but the toolkit, the traditional state social services toolkit's been too limited to make a difference for the hard cases.
It's been a case, I suppose, of continuing to support people who've fallen through the cracks, but no mechanism to intervene early and to lift them out of poverty that is self-perpetuating.
That's right. Yeah. And what the social investment toolkit shows you is that for a small number of people who need a lot more resource, for quite a number of people, the governments are doing things that simply don't work. They just don't have an impact. And unfortunately, for some governments, government services are making them worse. So people end up living quite chaotic, crisis-driven lives. They're trying to find their way around a system that was never designed for them. That was designed for people with much more orderly lives and with much more resource. And it's no wonder that they can persistently fail. On the other hand, there's also very little understanding of those who have the resilience to get through all that. We found with our highest risk young people, you're talking about 1% of your population, 2 or 3 out of 10 of them were getting the school leaving certification, which enabled them to go on to further training. Now, no one's ever asked how that happens. And we need to know, because those are lives of dignity and hope and aspiration, where despite huge challenges, these young people have been able to realise it. You won't find that written about in any policy handbook, any university course, any official bureaucratic papers. No one knows. Well, we should find out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Just finally, on sort of a broader political question, the national government did reforms that makes me as an Australian my eyes water, whether it be reducing the top marginal rate of tax to 33%, whether it be reducing company tax and broadening the GST to fund that, whether it be consolidating and yes, reducing welfare benefits, whether it be selling down the government's stake in state-owned enterprises, including Air New Zealand. Those reforms were not always popular in New Zealand, but they were accepted by the community. And the government succeeded in making the case for them. What advice would you give Australian policymakers whose track record recently of economic reform has been, to put it mildly, a little bit underwhelming?
Well, look, there's one critical difference, which I think helps explain a lot of this. In New Zealand, we had decisive events in 2008-10. So we got into a significant recession. And then we had a major earthquake in our second biggest city, which has ended up costing 20% of GDP to fix. So no one could argue there wasn't a reason to do some things differently.
Mm.
I think that was a critical factor. We also had some very effective political leadership in John Key, you know, elected with a strong mandate, a very settled party, and some real skills and a good team around him. And I was fortunate
good finance minister.
I was fortunate to be part of that team. And I think another thing was often just taking the, you know, being quite open with the public about the changes that you're making. And that actually happens here when you see the arguments about trying to get various tax reforms through the Senate.
Mm.
That does bring up all the issues. People get plenty of time to debate them.
Mm.
And that is the right kind of process if you can get agreement, of course.
Mm.
And we didn't have the complexity of the Senate. If you can get agreement, then people know all the arguments have been had and got there. So we tried to run very transparent, open policy processes so people could follow the logic. I'm a great believer in that. The public are quite capable of following the logic. Sometimes are quite complex arguments, but you have to understand it yourself.
Yeah.
And you have to be willing to lay it out. And that's not always easy because you can get a blowback that can easily unsettle politicians. So you've got to look at a more complex environment here. And of course, you've had so much success for so long. And New Zealand has always, you know, always sees Australia as a benchmark. There's a 30%.
It's the other way around these days, I can assure you.
Yeah, well, there's still a gap, pay gap. You can earn more for the same job here than you can in New Zealand. And we admire that success.
Mm.
And whatever the political comings and goings, the Australian economy and success seems to just keep continuing.
Well, let's hope so. But Sir Bill, thank you so much for your time, and thanks for coming in and having a chat.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks.
Okay, we now welcome back onto the show IPA Research Fellow Daniel Wild. Welcome back.
Great to be back.
Now, big week for you, Dan, where you have released the five reasons why the NEG would be bad for Australia. So we're going to go through these point by point, all five reasons, and then I think we might get into some Trump stuff at the end. So first things first, what is the NEG?
Well, the NEG is the National Energy Guarantee, and it's the government's main energy climate change policy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not actually implemented yet. It needs the agreement of the states through what's called COAG. There's a meeting later this month, and then we'll work out whether it's going to go ahead and in what form. But in general terms, what it has is a emissions reduction requirement and a reliability requirement. So the emissions reduction requirement is for Australia to meet its Paris Climate Accord targets of reducing emissions by at least 26% on 2005 levels by 2030.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a reliability component, which is that there needs to be a certain amount of dispatchable baseload power. And they implement that through pretty stringent regulations on energy retailers and large energy users. So the main issue here, well, I don't want to jump ahead, but I'm going to jump ahead.
Oh, that's damn. All right. Okay.
You do
that's
it while
right. That's all right. Just go over the flow. They're favoring, the key thing about the policy is it favors emissions reductions over reliability by a factor of 100 to 1. And that's because there's a penalty of a $100 million tax on energy retailers that don't meet their emissions reduction requirement, but only a tax of as little as $1 million when they don't meet their reliability requirements. So this is not a good policy, and that's why we're saying don't go ahead with it.
So clearly this shows that we're committed to emissions reduction more than anything else. And
yep.
So is it right in saying that Australia is basically the only country meeting its Paris obligations?
Yeah. So we know that the United States has withdrawn from the accord, and they're the second largest emitter of carbon.
Yep.
China, under the Paris Accord, can increase its emissions very rapidly. And we know there was a report out not so long ago by a pro-emissions reductions European-based organization. And even they found that none of the European nations are meeting they're not on track to meet their reduction requirements.
Literally zero.
Including France, which is where the treaty was actually drafted. So
if you think one country wants to really make sure that they honor the commitment.
Yeah, it'd be France. The interesting thing is it just shows how recalcitrant Europe is. I mean, we'll get into this. No, well, they're delinquent, right? We'll get into this later with Trump. But look, they're not meeting their NATO requirements. They say, yeah, we'll spend 2% of GDP on defense. They don't do it. Yeah, we'll meet our Paris Climate Accord requirements. They don't do it. So Australia has been playing for fools on the international stage, and we shouldn't be a part of it.
I've got a good stat that you can use in your media appearances. You might already know this, but actually under Trump in the last year, the USA has reduced its emissions by like 0.5%.
Yeah.
And every country in Europe or I don't know if it's every country in Europe or the EU as a whole has increased it by like 2%.
Is that right? Yeah. So that doesn't surprise me. The point you're sort of getting at
not
is...
Not Trump's trying to reduce emissions or anything. But
no, there's natural market reasons why emissions go down because there's an inbuilt incentive for energy generators to get more efficient at generating energy because it's lower cost. So under the status quo, you're going to get lower emissions anyway. What we're saying is that's fine, but just don't push renewables onto the market before they can provide affordable, reliable, dispatchable power.
Yeah, like the thing I've always said is like the guy that invents the car that doesn't emit but is also running as effective as like a car today is going to be the richest man ever.
Exactly.
Like there's this incentive to do it just on the market basis alone.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, then there's no reason to bring it on market quicker. And again, what Australia does makes no noticeable difference to the climate, which is another point we have in there. I mean, human activity accounts for only 3% of total carbon emissions on a global stage. Australia accounts for 1.5% of that. And our energy generation sector accounts for less than 1%, which is because the energy generation sector is the main target of the NEG. So, I mean, the reality, the unavoidable reality is what Australia does is not going to make a discernible difference to the environment.
But it does lead to good retweets from Malcolm Turnbull's Twitter account.
Exactly, at least to great retweets, and it also leads to great cocktail parties and business class flights for bureaucrats over to Paris and Brussels. So that's, I think that's the main objective of the policy. So we can say mission accomplished on that.
Yeah.
So you said this NEG
swamp, is what they call it.
Daniel's fired up this morning. So you said this NEG was going to be discussed next month at COAG.
Yeah.
What's the likelihood that it'll get up, or what form will it take if it gets up? What's the?
I think something will get up, but the states or the Labor state governments want more reckless emissions reductions targets. So that's going to be the main thing. This is the problem, right? It's not going to be improved when it comes to prices or reliability. It's going to get worse with emissions. So I think the government will cave and have even worse emissions reduction requirements and keep the same very low quality reliability. Well, there's no price requirement, right? So because there's no, it's contradictory to say you're going to lower prices and lower emissions. You can't do both at the same time. So. And that's, by the way, there's only two components. Like I say, there's reliability and there's emissions. There's no price target because they know they can't get prices down. Yeah. It's an emission that they can't get prices down. Otherwise, they'd have a price target.
Yeah.
Why don't Labor realise that they could recapture their base if they could offer them really cheap electricity?
Because they're totally captured by radical left-wing identity politics.
Yeah, they're with their new base. They're not their old base, but they're with the new base.
All the punters would be like, this is great.
Yeah, all the working class people. But, I mean, that's a really interesting point. There's probably 20 or 30% of the electorate out there that's up for grabs. When you look at, you know, some of these major policies, I mean, energy and immigration are two issues that both major parties are recalcitrant on. They're not answering to, they're not responding to what a lot of working class, middle class Australians want. The coalition, for whatever reason, is not interested in trying to capture them. And like I've said before, I think the future for conservatives is Western Sydney, not Toorak.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Cool. So we've hit most of the points in this parliamentary research brief. You can go to ipa.org.au if you want to read it. I just want to like make sure we cover all of them. So let's talk about why the NEG is not technologically neutral.
Yeah. So there's this claim that the NEG isn't going to be favouring any form of energy generation over another. That's false. And the reason it's false is because as soon as you have an emissions reduction requirement, that is automatically going to favour wind and solar. Right, so if you're saying we've got to reduce emissions, you've got to go to less carbon-intensive forms of energy generation, and that's wind and solar. So it's not like a direct subsidy like the renewable energy target is, but it's still providing regulatory privileges to renewables. And in that sense, the NEG is the functional equivalent of a carbon tax, of a renewable energy target, of an emissions intensity scheme, of a emissions trading scheme. They're all designed to favour renewables at the expense of coal.
Yeah, absolutely. They're just like different disguises for the exact same policy.
It's all the same thing. And even what's so interesting is even in the report by the Energy Security Board, which is a so-called independent COAG body for energy, even they say the way in which they achieve these reductions is through an emissions intensity target on retailers, on energy retailers. So, I mean, it's explicitly right there that they're implementing an emissions intensity target.
Yeah, absolutely. And the last one I want to talk about, so the NEG will diminish economic opportunity in Australia. Mm. So one of the stats you have here, which I thought was really interesting. So Australia has an abundance of natural resources. We've got over 1,000 years worth of coal. We've got 30% of the global uranium supplies, an abundance of natural gas.
Yeah.
And we seem to be running away from all of that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in the ACCC report that came out Not so long ago, they found that South Australia has the third highest electricity prices in the world, and Australia has the sixth highest electricity prices in the world. Mm. And we know that business investment as a percentage of GDP is just 11.7%, which is lower than what it was under the Whitlam years. And one of the key reasons for that is high and rising and unreliable electricity supply. I mean, you look at our high taxes, our red tape, and then on top of that, you put high electricity prices, and businesses are just deciding not to invest here, and this is going to undermine job creation and wages growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just one of the craziest stats. It's like we have all of those natural resources, and yet we have the highest prices of electricity in the world. Like something's gone terribly wrong.
And like no one else is following these treaties.
Yeah. Yeah, but like to bring you back to the point, you said like, oh, the US is turning their back, Europe's not. Like, isn't that what international treaties are? Like, no one ever does this.
Yeah.
Like, I thought, like what it's are just, we doing?
Yeah, it's
a good summary of international treaties.
Yeah, no one ever does it.
Yeah.
Except for us. Yeah. Apparently, Scott Hargoves was telling me that we're copying all this flak for not signing Kyoto, like the Howard government, but they were actually meeting,
their
obligations. Yeah, it's crazy. Why do we feel like we have to do this? Anyway.
Well, it's just I think a lot of it's just virtue signaling.
Yeah, we want to be loved. So. We want to be loved. We're too far away.
I think it's cocktail parties.
Cocktail party. I think it's also kind of like a sense of we want to be a bigger player than we are as Australia. I mean, we're a moderately sized country that has a moderate effect on anything global.
And we're pretty far away from
it. And we're far away from it. Let's just embrace it.
Yeah. Mary Kissel says we don't have a joke navy, though.
A joke navy?
We don't have a joke navy. So we have a significant navy.
Oh, okay, cool.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, we have a significant landmass, so that works.
Anyway.
Okay, cool. So let's bring it to the conclusion. So let's talk about like what Daniel Wilde, we make this guy the energy minister, what would you be doing?
Wow, I'd probably be going to Brussels, to be honest, cocktail parties. Yeah. I'd be in the swamp.
Yeah,
I'd get into it.
Yeah, you'd be like Scott Pruitt. He comes in with like the EPA, like a flamethrower to the thing, and then he's like, oh, look at all this money.
No, what I would be doing is withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord straight away. For the reasons we just outlined, and getting rid of emissions reductions as a component of our energy policy, because this has been driving high prices, not delivering any discernible benefit. And it's really just handouts for lobbyists and rent seekers when we want to get down to the truth. I mean, who benefits? Wind farm generators.
Yep.
Who suffers? Well, working class, middle class Australians and small business owners. So let's just get out of this policy of sponsoring renewable energy, and let's just focus on prices and reliability.
Cool. All right. Once again, so it is the five reasons why the NEG would be bad for Australia. You can go read it on our website right now. So we'll talk to another thing. So Daniel, huge fan of Trump. Big fan of the guy, right?
Pretty big Trump fan, yeah.
Pretty big Trump fan. So
he's got a Trump hat.
He does have a Trump hat.
MAGA.
cool. So... But a pretty rough week for the bloke. Yeah. So we talked about this earlier on the show. We got into a lot of the details. So we probably don't need to go back on that. But what did you think of the performance, and especially the, you know, the would and wouldn't quote?
Well, I think the press conference was a little bit bizarre and a bit strange. And I don't think that's the press conference he had with Putin in Russia, in Helsinki. I don't think he should have been so openly questioning the veracity of US intelligence relative to what Russia and Putin thought. But in what Trump has said is, why should I be trusting the Obama intelligence community and particularly the senior leaders? And I think that's right. And what we know is, I've got a couple of tweets here, which I might just read out.
Go ahead.
We have James Comey, who was the head of the FBI.
Yeah, this is a good one.
This is the guy who was the head of the FBI during the election under Obama. Okay. He says this: the Republican Congress has proven incapable of fulfilling the founders' design that ambition must counteract ambition. All who believe in this country's values must vote for Democrats this fall. Okay, so the former head of a major intelligence organization is saying vote Democrats. That's absolutely disgraceful. Can you imagine that happening here?
And you would have to be the most professional bloke in the world to not let that political bias when you're in like there affect your judgment on work matters.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then there's one other here from John Brennan, who was the head of the CIA throughout the election. Donald Trump's press conference performance in Helsinki rises to and exceeds the threshold of quote-unquote high crimes and misdemeanors. It was nothing short of treasonous. So you've got the former head of the CIA calling the president...
What's that in regards to?
The press conference that he gave with Putin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's just John Brennan, former head of the CIA. So
yeah, that's right.
You've got James Comey, former head of FBI, John Brennan, former head of CIA, both during the election campaign. And we're supposed to believe these guys were impartial during the election campaign? I don't think so. So the broader thing here is you've got the media, the Democrats, and the intelligence community trying to nullify the 2016 election. That's what's going on. And that's what's happening with Brexit, right? You've got the whole policy establishment community, EU, all these elites. They're trying to nullify the Brexit vote. They're trying to slow walk it and prevent it from going ahead. And so that's the big story here. So Trump said something silly in Helsinki. Who cares? Mm. The big thing here is they're basically calling for a coup against a democratically elected president. Why don't we talk about that?
One thing I want to pick, like, so you talk about how all these former FBI people, they've got a political bias. One thing I'm finding really interesting is like the, you know, left-wing celebrities who are now so totally defending the CIA and the FBI. Yeah. They're unimpeachable now. Like usually they were like spreading crack on the streets.
Yeah,
and, like,
exactly.
I saw Michael Moore, wait, I got this one here. So Michael Moore tweeted out like, Trump has asked, are we going to believe the Russians who own offices and he refused to choose? It's like this guy literally made Fahrenheit 9-1-1. He like talked about the Iraq war being an inside job.
Yeah.
But now that Trump's here, unimpeachable. Can't fault the bloke. And also, like, when Trump walked ahead of the Queen, and everyone's like, how can you be so disrespectful to the Queen?
Like you guys it's
like,
what, the Queen.
Like you guys have ever cared.
Toxic masculinity. Yeah. I'm surprised he didn't say that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, suddenly people care about the Queen from the left.
I don't care about his internal squabbles with the intelligence community. I only care about the end result of how he deals with Putin.
Mm.
And I think the jury's still out on that. What I would say is, though, none of those people cared when Obama allowed Russia to stagger into Ukraine.
Yeah. And Obama said to Putin that I'm going to have more flexibility after the second election. Do you know what I mean? Because you only have two terms in the US. So after you're elected the second term, who cares?
Yeah.
You're sorted. So he's like, I'm going to have more flexibility. I mean, imagine Trump said that I'm going to have more flexibility after the next election. I mean, what does that mean? So
front page news for 2 weeks.
New York Times. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the real interesting thing here is that, well, what it shows more broadly is all the left care about is power. They don't have principles. Right, and that's by their own admission. The postmodern left think everything's about power structures, and this is just another example. They'll pick anyone's side if it's going to forward their agenda. And I wouldn't be surprised if Democrats win the House and the Senate in the elections later this year, that they'll try and impeach Trump, and that's going to be horrific if they do that.
Well, if they do that, we'll have you back on the show, Daniel Wild. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Okay, thank you to Daniel Wild and to Sybil English for those interviews. Really interesting stuff. So we'll move on to some stories that have made us laugh this week. Yep. So I want to start with this one. So Trevor Noah, host of the US, The Daily Show, what is billed as a satirical news show. It's not. Ooh. I don't know if it's that funny anymore.
Wow.
Well, look, I'm not a fan. So he was doing a segment on the World Cup. Now, Trevor Noah, born and raised in South Africa, he's come over to the US, very proud of being from Africa, and it's a source of a lot of his material.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, talking about France winning the World Cup, started to say, France didn't win the World Cup, and he starts, doing a bit of a dance saying, Africa won the World Cup, Africa won the World Cup, or something to that effect. But anyway, and then he goes on to say, I get it, you have to say it's the French team, but like this is a direct quote. I get it, they have to say it's the French team, but look at those guys. You don't get that tan by hanging out in the south of France, my friends. So like, it's just like one of those things where you're like, really?
Yeah.
Like, if you're white, can you say that?
Oh, well, you definitely can't.
But, yeah, exactly.
So carry on.
Well, so this was something that went around on Twitter, which was like, there was like the photo of the French national team and it was like all their countries of origin, which was actually false because pretty much all of them, like 21 out of 23 were actually born in France.
Yeah.
Another one moved over when he was two. Like all of them at least were educated and they learned how to play soccer in France and they feel French and obviously they're playing for the French national team. Like they feel a loyalty to France.
Yeah, and he's basically saying you're not really French.
You're not really French, you're from black. Africa. Yeah, because you're black. That's literally what he's saying. So the French ambassador to the US got involved and he wrote a letter to Trevor Noah, which Trevor Noah read out, not on the show, but it was released through Facebook. The French ambassador said the comedian was denying their Frenchness by calling them African. Quote here, this even in jest legitimizes the ideology which claims whiteness as the only definition of being French. They were educated in France, they learned to play soccer in France, and they're French citizens. They're proud of their country, France. Sounds pretty good to me. Trevor Noah then responds like, oh, when I'm saying they are African, I'm not saying it as a way to exclude them from their Frenchness, but I'm using it as a way to include them in my Africanness.
Yeah.
To which I will return to, I get it, they have to say it's a French team, but look at those guys, you don't get that tan by hanging out in the south of France, my friends. You are denying them their Frenchness.
That's not what you said, mate.
Yeah, you said Africa won the World Cup. I can't think of something less French than you saying Africa won the World Cup.
He made quite a thoughtful response and he said, you know, they can be French and African. And it's like, yeah, but that's not what you said.
Yeah, yeah. They can, but that's not what you said.
Yeah, it's always funny when a smug lefty who gets lols for saying stuff that everyone agrees with gets in trouble for something like this.
Yeah, because this went off in France.
A bit of confected outrage merchant. Yeah.
Like, he was copying it from so many different French people saying like, no, these are French people.
Yep.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But I think he would have had a lot of supporters from white supremacists in France with the idea of like...
Well, yeah.
Yeah. I think they would have really gone on board with
that. He literally stated that in his response. He was like, I've become aware that neo-Nazis in France don't consider these guys French. It's like, that's it.
So mate. You want to go away from that. If you realize that, then you might be wrong.
Yeah. Anyway, so Trevor Noah got himself in a bit of trouble Good on him.
More of it.
Not good on him.
No, good on him for giving us podcast material.
Yeah, it's good material. Yeah. All right. So I've got two segments this week called Communist Girl 1, Communist Girl 2. Communist Girl 1.
Give me number 1 first.
Okay, Communist Girl 1, which is probably the biggest story, although I don't know which one's the biggest story, is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who won, of course, that upset primary in New York.
Yeah.
New York.
All right, in full defense for her, she does say she's a socialist, but yeah, she's...
Socialist Democrat. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm verbaling her, but
yeah,
this is...
Sorry, I interrupted the...
No, that's right. There wasn't a thing. Anyway, so what did she say? So she was doing an interview during the week where she sort of glibly remarked, Israel's the occupying power of Palestine, and the interviewer said, "What do you mean by that?"
Can you unpack
that a bit.
I think we've got the audio here.
Oh, okay. Let's play the audio. Yeah, we've got the audio.
You use the term the occupation of Palestine.
Mm.
What did you mean by that?
I think what I meant is like the settlements that are increasing in some of these areas and places where Palestinians are experiencing difficulty in access to their housing and homes.
Do you think you can expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd also just... I am not the expert on geopolitics on this issue.
Anyway, so that's pretty funny. Obviously, I'm out of her depth on that. She's also out of her depth on economic policy, which is completely surprising for a socialist. But she said that there's low unemployment is because everyone has two jobs, which is not true. 5% of the workers in America have two jobs, which is less than it used to be. And she said unemployment is caused by and poverty is caused by capitalism.
Oh,
which is fundamentally untrue.
Yeah. I thought it was the opposite, but...
It's definitely the opposite. So she's forgetting about those billion people that have been lifted out of poverty since 1990 as a result of free market economics and trade throughout the world. And she also said everyone's working 60 to 70 hours a week, which is not true because working hours are about the same in America for the last 10 years, 34.5 hours a week approximately for private sector workers in America.
Where were you on this show, Pete?
Yeah, well, you know...
responding to person.
You go.
Oh, I was just going to say, pretty rough interview for it. But going back to the audio of the Israel thing, like, I've always thought, why don't politicians say I don't know more often? Mm. And they always like get themselves into worse trouble. And then that footage is like, that's why they don't say I don't know. That was so bad.
She should have realized she didn't know before she made a statement.
Yes, like, I wonder if that's part of it. But when she eventually bits like, I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That was bad.
Well, that answer was better than stuff about economics, because saying I don't know is worse than being wrong.
After listening to that, I genuinely don't know if that's true anymore.
And but anyway, this all goes to my theory of it's easy to be a lefty.
Yes.
Because it's easy to explain.
Yeah.
You know, you just have to have a feeling,
mm-hmm.
you know. And like, you know, she seems like a nice person.
Yep.
But she's just, not really up to it.
No, probably not. All right. Someone who is up to it this week, mostly. So Obama gave... Like, he's on a hot streak. Like, he gave a speech at the Nelson Mandela Memorial. I think it was, like, Nelson Mandela. It would have been his 100th birthday or something this week.
I think so.
Yeah, yeah. So, he gave a speech and some really cool quotes coming out of it. So, you know, there's a whole lot of things you can take out of this. So, going back to the Trevor Noah thing, one of the things he says is he's talking about the benefits of immigration. He says, just look at the French football team that just won the World Cup. Not all of these folks look like cools to me, but they're French. And it talks about, like, embracing the common humanity, which is, I think, what Trevor Noah was like. That's what Trevor Noah the second time around thought. Definitely not the first time. And also said, he's talking about, like, you know, when people say, oh, you can't say that because you're a straight white man. You can't have an intelligent conversation. You can't do this if you insist that those who aren't like you because they are white or because they are male, somehow there is no way they can understand what I'm feeling, that they somehow lack standing to speak on certain matters. So really cool stuff coming out of Obama. Hopefully there's more of it. I'm a little... he gave a subsequent speech, the clip came out today, where he talks about how men have been annoying me because they're so violent. Yeah. So baby steps, but hopefully this is the start of something new.
Well, I reckon he definitely got a backlash because those first two comments, I was like, maybe Obama's doing the reverse Malcolm Fraser and he's actually sort of becoming more solid once he leaves office. And he was sort of doing, you know, Nelson Mandela had his life destroyed by white supremacism, yet came out of jail and still, you know... connected with the white community in South Africa.
Yeah, yeah.
And they still love him. Like, the majority of them.
As Obama said when he starts talking about, like, you know, you can't say that because you're straight white male, it's like Nelson Mandela in prison was learning
Afrikaans
so he could talk to white people.
Yeah, to his jailers. So a good point.
Yes.
That's not the word, but whatever. And then it's like, so I've just got this image that Andrew Bushnell sent through of Obama with the microphone saying, women, so this is when he says, men have been getting my words, like, men have been getting on my nerves lately. And then women in particular, by the way, I want you to get more involved. Like, it's completely fine to be a patronizing mansplainer if, like,
you're Obama.
Yeah. It's like, I think I'll get involved if I want to, mate. Yeah. Anyway.
Cool.
So, a mixed week for Obama.
Indeed. Let's go into Communist Girl number 2.
All right, Communist Girl number 2. And this one was the more volatile, I guess, story. Ash Sacker, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that, a young activist in Britain, was on TV, I think Good Morning Britain, whatever, yep. a morning TV show with Piers Morgan and a couple of others, and they got into a head debate about Trump and Obama. And, you know, Piers Morgan was talking over her and saying, you didn't protest Obama even though he was bad to immigrants. And she was, and he said that Obama is, you know, you're a big Obama fan. And she couldn't get a word in and eventually just shouted out, you know, I don't like Obama. I'm a communist, you idiot, right? And this was lauded on Twitter. She got, you know how people say, oh, you won the internet for today. Such a stupid saying. Anyway, she won the internet.
But she did. She definitely won the internet.
She went nuts. And it's like, you know, the obvious point is, why do you get lauded for promoting an ideology that killed 100 million people?
So my point with this one was just like, you know, spot the lie. She's both a communist and Piers Morgan is an idiot. Like, I completely agree with her on that point. Like,
oh, he's a bullhead.
Yeah. That was one of the worst 2 minute stretches of television I've ever seen. Like, they just, no one's seating ground. Everyone's shouting at each other. They can't be stopped. Mm. And I did love how much the co-host laughed when Saka called Piers Morgan an idiot. Like, yeah. There was something real to that.
Yeah, yeah, because she has to sit next to him every day.
Every morning. It's 3 hours of Piers.
What happened to me? You know, I had so much promise. Anyway, so that would be, obviously, it's really bad that, you know, young people can. And I noticed that they have released T-shirts, which they're selling on the internet, which you can buy in our flourishing capitalist economy, which says...
What type of economy?
I'm a communist. I'm literally a communist.
Yep.
So, good on you.
It's a new Che Guevara's face.
I mean, it's an obvious
pure
point.
Pure irony.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, that's right. I remember those. And it's the obvious point, but you don't have to make it. What if someone said, I'm a neo-Nazi, you idiot?
Yeah. Or just like, I'm a capitalist, you idiot, in a communist country. Yeah. Like, you're not being on TV for long after that.
That's right.
Cool. I got another one here. So this California mayor wants to pass legislation that would prevent employers in his city from requiring that male employees wear neckties. Wants to get rid of neckties. So he's a mayor of Lancaster, Rex Paris. He says, I spend a lot of hours every week on an elliptical or a bike just to increase blood flow to my brain. Good on you, mate. And turns out every morning when I put a tie on, I'm diminishing it. So reason, you know, we talk about them on this podcast a lot. We link to them a lot. They're this free market think tank in the US. They got in touch with them. They're like, can we confirm that you are banning the requirement for ties for public sector workers or private sector? And he gets back and says, no, definitely private sector. And then sent a press release reiterating that research ties restrict blood flow to the brain. I like the story. I'm just like, how desperate do you have to be the cool politician?
Oh,
like, guys. Yeah. I want to get rid of neckties.
Yeah.
I want to get rid of neckties. It's really cool. I've got other legislation. Like, everyone has to skateboard everywhere and everyone has to listen to my old vinyl collections.
I'm not the cool dad.
I'm the cool dad. Come on. I'm the cool dad.
Yeah.
I sit backwards in a chair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm here. I'm listening.
I'm down with the video games.
And I've just got this image of this middle-aged bloke on a bike.
So much Lycra.
I'm increasing the blood flow to my brain.
Yeah. And then I've got to put on that dreaded necktie.
Yeah, the patriarchy. Yeah. Like the yoke of the patriarchy is...
All right.
What's the word?
I don't know, like, where you're going.
Like, you know, like the tie. That's what I always say. I always say, you know, I have to wear this bloody tie.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, so it might be you. Anyway, we'll move on to Elon Musk and then we better get out of here.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Elon Musk. So obviously we thank Elon for all the material. Last week we told
you... I'm like the Thai rescue chief. We're loving Elon Musk's material that he keeps delivering to us.
Send your submarine here, Elon. Anyway, so he got in trouble... Well, he described last week how he tried to force his magic submarine on the rescue effort in Thailand, had a crack at the bloke for not using it, even though he successfully extracted the children from the cave.
And then just called him a pedophile?
Well, no, that was this week.
Yeah, I know.
So, I mean, he called it, one of the divers a pedo, which, excuse my French, not, you know. The other thing that happened...
Are you sure it's French? Well, don't want to be letting Trevor Noah know.
Well, yeah, it's not. I don't want a letter from the ambassador of France, but it turns out the other thing that was really funny this week is Elon Musk. Is it turns out he's a Republican, right? So someone's been sitting on this, right, and waiting for Elon Musk to have a fall, and then they've released this info. Actually, Elon Musk is a Republican donor. It's like that's caused as much outrage as him calling someone a pedo.
Yeah, so he's a top donor to a Republican PAC that raised about $8 million for the Republican Party. So, like, you know, that's a fair bit of money.
It's funny because, like, lefties love this guy. Yeah. Right? Like, he's this cool tech guy.
Yeah,
you know,
and he's like going to send us to space. And he's going to power South Australia.
What? He's a Republican? Anyway, this was the guy who's going to give us the batteries.
Yeah, this is a battery.
Is that still
guy.
On? What's happening with those?
I think that's on. Okay. And you don't want to back out now because you don't know what kind of like schoolyard slur he's going to throw at you if you back out of the battery now.
Imagine the guy who'll prove that he's like, oh, he's not popular anymore.
Damn it.
Okay, that's all I've got on him.
All right, cool. That's it for the show this week. Thank you to Sibylle English and to Daniel Wild for the interviews. Really interesting stuff. So you can go read Daniel Wild's parliamentary research brief on our website.
Oh, yeah, the Wild Thing.
The Wild Thing in the studio with us now. So cool. This podcast is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, and wait, I had it here. Sorry, it's Tuck. Tuck to our Swedish listeners in Spotify.
Yeah.
That is, thank you. So make sure you guys are subscribed to any of those ones that you want. And if you do have a friend that you do think would like the podcast, they didn't have iTunes, you can tell them that we're on Spotify now. And if you are listening on iTunes, make sure you're leaving us a 5-star rating. If you like the show, you can also leave us a comment, maybe a tip for the show. Nina, if people want to make more of a financial commitment to the IPA, they want to get involved as like a member or a donor, where can people go?
Just visit the website at ipa.org.au, and by becoming a member, you become one of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
Yeah, let's go cool. Listen to some Millencolin.
Absolutely, let's get out of here.